Chief Justice Fabe is being escorted into the chambers, shaking the hands of the House Speaker and Senate President. And now we go to the annual State of the Judiciary Address.
President Huggins, Speaker Chenault, Senators and Representatives and Guests, the State of the Judiciary presents a welcome opportunity to highlight both the achievements of the Alaska court system and the challenges it faces. And on behalf of all of the court system employees statewide, I would like to thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. Before I begin my remarks, I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues on the Alaska Supreme Court. Justice Daniel Winfrey of Fairbanks is a lifelong Alaskan appointed by Governor Sarah Palin in 2007 after a long and distinguished career in private practice. He serves as our court's liaison to the National Conference of Bar Examiners, which sets best practices for determining the admission to the practice of law. And today is his birthday. Justice Craig Stowers was appointed by Governor Sean Parnell in 2009 after a career in private practice and several years on the Superior Court bench. He's the dedicated chair of the Court System's Security and Emergency Preparedness Committee, which works to protect the safety of court personnel and court users statewide. And he also serves on Alaska's delegation to the Uniform Law Commission, which develops model legislation for states in challenging areas of law. Justice Stowers. Justice Peter Mawson was appointed by Governor Parnell in 2012 after an accomplished career in private practice. He serves as chair of both the Supreme Court's Judicial Education Committee and the Supreme Court's Access to Civil Justice Committee. Justice Mawson. And finally, Justice Joel Bolger, the newest member of the court, was appointed by Governor Parnell just over a year ago. Justice Bolger is a highly experienced jurist and was long before he joined the court, having served as a judge at every level of our judicial system in Valdez, Kodiak, and Anchorage. Justice Bolger currently serves as co-chair with Attorney General Michael Garrity of the Criminal Justice Working Group. Justice Bolger. And we also have with us former Justice Walter Carpinetti, with whom I served on the Supreme Court for 15 years. He's here with us today. I'd also like to acknowledge the member of the court's administrative staff who are with us today, Christine Johnson, the administrative director, Doug Wolliver, deputy director, Marilyn May, clerk of the appellate courts, and Lisa Robertson, assistant to the director. And Nancy Mead, General Counsel, is unable to be with us today because of a family commitment. Also with us today is someone I'm very pleased to introduce to you, Suzanne DiPietro, the new Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. The Council plays a vital role in both the judicial selection and retention processes. And in the decades since statehood, the studies that the Council's conducted to improve the administration of justice have helped us create and maintain one of the most respected judiciaries in the nation. Ms. DiPietro has been a public sector attorney in Alaska for over 25 years, including both long tenures with both the Alaska Judicial Council and the court. I believe that you'll find her extremely responsible and responsive to the public. She brings a wealth of talent and experience to the council's important work. Suzanne. In recent years, the State of the Judiciary Address has focused on seizing opportunities to make significant changes in the way we do business. My immediate predecessor as Chief Justice, Walter Carpinetti, urged us to consider smart justice principles to address the skyrocketing costs associated with incarceration and our alarming rates of recidivism in criminal cases. The Criminal Justice Working Group and the legislature continue to explore measures that embody smart justice. And last year, I urged that we work together to develop local justice initiatives in our remote villages, including coordinating more closely with the tribal courts. Today, hints of progress are being seen in this area among the three branches, including our adoption of a new court rule on implementing restorative justice practices such as circle sentencing at the local level. New approaches to justice delivery are being earnestly explored and are gaining traction. To me, this demonstrates something that I've always believed, which is that all of us, as public servants, take our responsibility to serve justice seriously, and we approach them carefully, and we are willing to embark in new directions when time and the circumstances warrant. Looking back to the first State of the Judiciary address I was privileged to present to you in 2001 highlights just how rapidly and remarkably we've adapted together to changing demands. At that time, I spoke of the need to improve the way we manage case information, to make it more readily accessible to judges, attorneys, agencies, and members of the public. Today, we have a computerized case management system, CourtView, in all court locations statewide. CourtView makes gaining access to court records significantly easier for all concerned. In 2001, I spoke of a promising new approach to handling criminal cases involving defendants with drug and alcohol addiction, an approach that would emphasize treatment, education, and employment as a way to slow the revolving doors of our jails. Today, we have therapeutic courts in Anchorage, Bethel, Fairbanks, Juneau, Ketchikan, and Palmer that not only reduce our rates of recidivism, but also help many Alaskans break the cycle of addiction to resume sober and productive lives. I spoke of the rise in the number of self-represented litigants and the need to ensure that they navigate the legal system as smoothly as possible. Today, we have the nationally recognized Family Law Self-Help Center. The center assists thousands of Alaskans each year through an extensive website of forms and instructions, regular workshops, and a statewide telephone helpline. And I spoke of the importance of exploring alternative dispute resolution in child custody cases to avoid the damage to family relationships that can occur during the more traditional adversarial process. Today, we have the Child Custody and Visitation Mediation Program available for free in many communities. This mediation program has helped over 1,000 Alaskan parents and children survive family breakup in a less stressful, more peaceful manner. Strong court mediation programs have been established for child protection, small claims, and adult guardianship and conservatorship cases as well. The Early Resolution Program, founded just 3 years ago with the help of volunteer mediators and attorneys, has now helped over 650 families in three of our highest volume courts, Anchorage, Palmer, and Juneau. Approximately 80% of these families have avoided protracted legal proceedings by working with volunteer attorneys and court mediators to resolve their child custody, child support, and property disputes, usually within weeks after their cases are filed. I recently presided over two early resolution court calendars, and I can say from personal experience that it is a highly effective and beneficial approach. Of the 12 cases on my dockets, 8 fully settled, and the parties left the courtroom with their final divorce decrees and, where applicable, with a child support order. 2 more reached settlement on most issues and were expected to finally resolve soon. Not only were most of these families able to move on with their lives more quickly, with less strife and disruption, but the court was able to close these cases after just a few hours of volunteer attorney and court time. Each of these programs, CourtView, the Family Law Self-Help Center, Therapeutic Courts, the Child Custody and Visitation Mediation Program, and the Early Resolution Program, represent remarkable steps forward that couldn't have happened without the innovation, dedication, and hard work of many talented people, both court staff and community volunteers. And none of these programs would have succeeded in becoming such vital components to our justice system without your steady support. Making fundamental changes in the way we do things is always an exercise in patience, courage, and faith for all of us. But the results have been nothing short of profound for many, many people in this state, and we can all be proud of the difference our contributions have made. Our work together has brought real advances in justice delivery, but it's also proven something else that's just important, just as important. It's shown that our conversations matter, that we do, in fact, function best when we communicate closely with each other and apply ourselves cooperatively to the tasks at hand. Alaskans are best served when we come to the table to share ideas and concerns with as much information and as many perspectives as possible. I'm grateful to you for always keeping a seat open for us, though through events like today's address, your attendance at this morning's informal breakfast with judges and court staff, and your participation in the new judicial ride-along program. The program provides an opportunity for legislators to meet with judges and see firsthand the role that courts play in the justice system and the influence they have on the daily lives of our citizens. It's in this spirit of engagement and exchange that I'd like to address two themes that, to me, form the foundation of the progress we've made together: stewardship and service. The dictionary defines stewardship as the careful and responsible management of something entrusted to one's care. Service is defined as being of help, use, or benefit to others. The calls to stewardship and service are familiar to each of us because all of us are stewards of the public trust, and all of us are public servants. Today, I'd like to share with you a few steps the court system's taking toward fulfilling the responsibility we've been given, both as stewards of and servants to society's promise of justice. Good stewardship means being mindful in all our administrative decision-making of the likely impacts on funding, facilities, and personnel. It means identifying and implementing viable alternatives for justice delivery using existing resources before pursuing new ones. And it means working smart and doing more with less so that we can continue to operate in the manner the Constitution requires of us, even in the face of budget constraints. Several current initiatives in court statewide illustrate our progress. First, we've adopted an all-hands-on-deck approach to judicial needs. When judicial calendars become tight from caseload demands and higher trial rates, we've been able to enlist retired judges to serve in a temporary pro tem capacity. To give just a few examples, senior Superior Court judges Larry Card and Nisha Steinkruger have helped cover busy dockets in Anchorage and Nome, respectively. Senior District Court judges Natalie Finn and Ray Funk have spent significant time covering calendars in Bethel and Dillingham. And my longtime colleague, Senior Justice Warren Matthews, who served on the Supreme Court for 32 years before retiring 5 years ago, has filled in not only in appellate matters, but also for trial court and magistrate judges in Anchorage and Juneau. Judicial workloads vary, based not only on the number of cases filed in a given jurisdiction, but on the number of cases that go to trial. So judges are often called upon to travel and cover for each other to avoid case backlogs, both within their own judicial district and across all districts. Juneau has one of the highest caseloads per judge in the state, and judges from Sitka, Ketchikan, and even Anchorage have traveled there to help ensure that the cases are handled in a timely manner. The only limitation on our ability to maximize judicial coverage here in Juneau is the lack of available courtroom space in the Diamond Courthouse. When Juneau judges are in town, there's no room for visiting judges, and when they're away, their courtrooms are never empty. Thanks in large part to dedicated judges, both active and retired, we've been able to provide consistent judicial coverage in a flexible and cost-saving manner without the need for new judicial positions. Given current fiscal times, this is an achievement we can all appreciate. Another announcement I'm pleased to make concerns a legislative appropriation that we will be returning to the state treasury. For fiscal year 2014, we received a one-time appropriation of $40,000 to support a 24/7 sobriety program, a pilot project in Fairbanks that requires twice daily alcohol testing for defendants released on bail who are ordered not to drink. The funds were intended to cover the startup phase, but Superior Court Judge Doug Blankenship was able to find a vendor willing to cover those startup costs without public monies. Because of the cost-conscious approach of this judge and the vendor, $40,000 will be returned to the general fund to you for you to apply to another public need. On a related note, our work to implement electronic filing, also known as e-filing, continues. Federal courts have allowed e-filing for many years, and many other state courts now require that court documents be filed electronically. These courts report increased efficiencies from the streamlined manner in which electronic documents can be accessed, shared, and stored, as well as better availability for court records to justice agencies and members of the public. We'll begin testing e-filing in domestic violence cases in Anchorage, Kenai, and Kotzebue by the end of the fiscal year. In addition, we've received a one-time $50,000 grant to create an electronic charging form. This form will be initially used by the municipality of Anchorage, which files over 20% of the criminal cases statewide, and it will eventually be used by state prosecutors. Anchorage Superior Court Judge William Morse chairs the court's e-filing committee, and I'm confident that the coming year will bring great strides under his leadership. All three examples, maximizing existing judicial coverage, guarding the dollars you've appropriated to us, and implementing more streamlined and economical access to court documents, illustrate how attention to detail and close cooperation among all concerned can allow us to preserve funds while we're still preserving our commitment to effective justice delivery. Our obligation to fulfill the promise of justice, of equal justice, is fundamental and cannot be compromised. But functioning as economically as possible doesn't undermine this obligation. In fact, it strengthens it and protects it. In these days of budget constraints, the ability to stretch limited resources helps guarantee that we continue to function well despite fiscal challenges. And our efforts to stretch public funds are not limited to court resources. Many state agencies support the functioning of our justice system and all draw from the same public treasury. So good stewardship requires that we support other agencies in their efforts to better serve the public. As you know, we recently launched a project in Fairbanks that gives law enforcement officers electronic access to bail orders entered by the Fairbanks court. Suddenly, for the first time, an officer in the field can determine immediately whether an individual is out on bail, and if so, whether the person's complying with the conditions of release. If not, the officer can make an immediate arrest. The project is already making a difference in Fairbanks. Within the first 2 months after the project started, there was a 60% increase in the number of arrests for bail violations compared to the prior year. Given the effectiveness of this project and the strong endorsement of the law enforcement community, our ultimate goal is to make bail information available electronically throughout the state, on the street, instantly, at all hours. The resulting enhancement of public safety will be tremendous for the community in general, and in particular for victims of domestic violence and other crimes. By working together, we can help law enforcement officers make the best use of their limited resources to keep our communities safe. Also, for years, we've facilitated on-site arraignments within jails and juvenile detention centers. We've authorized telephonic hearings where appropriate. And we've expanded the use of video conferencing when the personal presence of a party or witness is not essential to the fair disposition of the issues at hand. These steps have meant fewer prisoner transports to courthouses at public expense and lower travel costs for private parties faced with the onerous task of litigating in a state as large and remote as ours. These are just some examples of the many ways in which we work with other justice agencies to ensure the wisest use of public dollars. And our efforts to conserve resources are by no means one way. Other state agencies and organizations help us to operate more cost-effectively too. For example, the Child Support Services Division has facilitated the success of the court's early resolution program by providing caseworkers on site during the program's regular settlement conferences. By making child support information and calculations available to the court immediately while the parties, parents, attorneys, mediators, and the judge are all present together, the agencies helped the parties come to terms with their respective obligations without delay and the cost of further court proceedings, and the parties can leave with not only their divorce decree, but their child support order in hand. Alaska Legal Services Corporation coordinates the volunteer attorneys who devote countless hours to the early resolution program. helping us ensure that expensive judicial resources are reserved for only those cases that truly require them. No doubt, Alaska Legal Services, Child Support Services, and the attorney volunteers for the Early Resolution Program do the work they do because they see the positive effect it has on troubled families. But the dedicated work of these agencies and individuals have a very positive impact on our ability to stretch our resources and to serve all the people of Alaska well. When the court and others in the justice community work together to function as efficiently as possible, we secure the promise of justice for both present and future generations. This, to me, is the core of good stewardship. And with good stewardship, we can ensure that we continue to serve the public to the best of our ability. Remembering the call to service is essential to the operating of a well-functioning justice system, and we're working on promising new developments in this area as well. Coming to court is a scary proposition for almost everyone. For parties, much is at stake. Outcomes are uncertain, and the anxiety can be overwhelming. For victims, witnesses, jurors, concerned friends and family, the court process can be intimidating. It can be difficult to comprehend. It can be disruptive to their lives. With the rise in self-representation, attorneys no longer play as large a role in calming fears and describing to parties what to expect and how to prepare. Many people enter our doors without even a basic understanding of the adversarial process, and this can lead to distress for parties and delays in courtrooms. Against this backdrop, the court system has much work to do to make the legal process more understandable and less stressful to all concerned. Good models for addressing the mental strain and emotional turmoil court users face can be found in the medical community. Some doctor's offices and medical providers make a practice of contacting patients in advance of a medical procedure to see if they have questions or concerns and to make sure that they're adequately prepared. I'm convinced that we could use a similar outreach approach within the court system to quiet the nerves of those who face the daunting legal process and to ensure that parties arrive on time with the materials that they need to proceed. There are several concrete steps that we can take to this end. First, we can give greater assistance to litigants themselves. The Family Law Self-Help Center has shown that court staff and volunteers can render cost-effective support services by giving information about court procedures without providing legal advocacy or advice. Self-represented litigants who receive this type of information and support in advance of court proceedings arrive more prepared, more at ease, and more focused on what is relevant. As a consequence, their proceedings tend to go more smoothly and achieve results to everyone's benefit. Basic information about what to bring to court and what will happen in court is powerful, and the public is eager for it. So we're now exploring models for contacting self-represented litigants in advance of their court dates through phone or email or text messages to remind them of when and where to go, what to bring, and to give them the opportunity to ask basic questions about court procedure. In addition, we can minimize the inconvenience and disruption court proceedings place on a citizen's daily life. Traditionally, going to court has been a Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. proposition. Court hours and business hours have typically overlapped, requiring citizens who use the court to take time off to work, time off of work to handle even the most routine court matters. Acknowledging the difficulty this creates for many, I asked the presiding judges in the two largest judicial districts to explore expansion of court hours in some of our courthouses, and they were successful. Recently, we expanded the court hours available to handle certain routine matters to evenings and weekends in Anchorage and Saturdays in Fairbanks, and the response from these communities has been overwhelmingly positive. Parties in these locations now have the option of scheduling a name change or a traffic matter or an uncontested dissolution proceeding at a time that doesn't conflict with their jobs, affording litigants a greater opportunity to schedule cases according to their own needs, reduces the inconvenience of coming to court, and provides better service to the public. Palmer was the pioneer in this effort when it started the community court calendar that offers expanded hours 3 evenings a week and on Saturdays. We are indebted to the court staff who've worked hard to make these changes happen, And I'm especially grateful to 3rd District Presiding Judge Centon and Area Court Administrator Carol McAllen, and 4th District Presiding Judge Michael McDonald and Area Court Administrator Ron Woods for implementing these changes through flexible scheduling of magistrate judges without any additional resources. Second, we can improve the jury experience. I recently convened a new jury service project, which I invited 4th District Presiding Judge Michael McDonald to co-chair with me. The aim is to reduce the burden of jury service, especially in communities with small pools of jurors and high rates of trial. We're refining our standards for the numbers of jurors to call for a specific type of case, to avoid the costs and hardship that arise when a larger number is called than necessary. We're considering an expansion of the number of communities from which potential jurors can be drawn, to make a wider pool available, and to spread the obligation more broadly and fairly. And we're developing new jury orientation materials, including a statewide juror video, to make participation less confusing. And finally, we're hoping to make better use of technology to keep jurors informed both before and during their service by using simple text, phone, or email reminder messages, just as the airlines do. We could advise prospective jurors in a timely way of dates and times to report for service, of schedule changes, or of unanticipated delays. Jury service is the cornerstone of our system of justice, and we must all do what we can to assure that Alaskans view it as a privilege of citizenship and not a burden to be avoided. The framers of our Constitution established trial by jury, and it's part of our heritage. Third, we can provide more comprehensive and meaningful services to parents and children involved in domestic relations cases. We've learned through the court's successful mediation initiatives, especially the Early Resolution Project, that outcomes turn out best when we invest early in parents' capacity and willingness to solve their own problems. They're the ones who know their families, and they're the ones who know their children. In most cases, the best service we can give is to help parents chart their own course out of the storm. It's been many years since we systematically examined the way we handle child custody cases, and a lot has changed. Far more parents are attempting to represent themselves. In over 80% of child custody cases resolved this past year, one or both parties appeared without an attorney to assist them. We've also seen a dramatic increase, 50% over the last 5 years, in the number of motions to modify previously entered orders on child custody and support. So later this month, I'm bringing together a wide range of professionals who work with family law cases for a child custody summit. I'm asking these individuals to evaluate what we're currently doing and to assess what more we might be able to do to make child custody proceedings less complex, more collaborative, less adversarial, and more affordable. A child custody battle can be a shattering event for a family, and the adversarial system wasn't designed to handle the sensitive and deeply personal issues arising out of family relationships. I'm confident that we can significantly reform the child custody process to better serve the needs of parents and children, and that we can do so without the need for additional resources. Fourth, we can improve services in our rural single-judge court locations where unique circumstances pose significant challenges. Rural courts serve isolated communities where many residents have limited English proficiency, and the institutional presence of justice-related agencies is sparse, and local services and resources for treatment, supervision, and oversight vary widely. Distances between residents and the nearest courthouse can be hundreds of miles, and many proceedings are held telephonically, with the judge and parties seeing each other rarely, if ever. The feelings of isolation and alienation and detachment must be great as people face an important event in their lives without a real sense of direct participation. As I stressed in my remarks last year, if there's any place where adequate justice delivery demands our keen attention and creativity, it's in rural Alaska. This past fall, I invited tribal court judges to join state court judges so we could learn together from a national expert about new techniques for handling cases involving self-represented litigants, 11 tribal court judges representing 9 tribal courts attended the joint training, which was co-sponsored by the Supreme Court's Fairness, Diversity, and Equality Committee. Breakout sessions during the training gave state and tribal judges invaluable opportunities to share perspectives and approaches, and led to stronger relationships that have carried over. Increased collaboration between state and tribal judges is already occurring. For example, Judge Kimberly Sweet of the Kenaitse Tribe in Kenai, who attended the joint training and was at my breakout table, has approached the Kenai court about possibly collaborating on cases involving children as well as on a therapeutic DUI court. I'm hopeful that other judges are having similar conversations about tribal therapeutic courts, tribal diversion programs, and better ways to supervise probationers in their home communities. These conversations may lead to solutions that will make the fabric of rural justice stronger over time. The Fairness, Diversity, and Equality Committee has also convened a subcommittee of state and tribal judges to look at the different ways communities across the state handle minor consuming alcohol cases. The subcommittee will bring together judges and other professionals for a conference to discuss best practices for approaching minor consuming cases. One result of the conference may be that more of these cases are referred to tribal courts under the authorizing statute, which permits state judges to refer minor consuming cases to community diversion panels such as tribal courts and elder councils and other local entities. But this statutory provision appears to be rarely used. By helping to ensure that village youth who drink alcohol are held accountable in their own communities, state and tribal judges could serve the intent of the legislation, which, while also providing an avenue for important state-tribal cooperation and coordination. Toward this end, we're also exploring the potential for more local referrals in appropriate cases under Civil Rule 100, which allows civil cases to be referred to tribal courts or other local entities as the parties request for mediation. And the Supreme Court recently adopted a new court rule that allows local communities to play a role in assessing the impacts of criminal behavior and to help shape the consequences through circle sentencing and other restorative justice projects. But there's still so much that needs to be done. By the end of the year, I plan to gather our rural judges and court personnel together for a rural court case management workshop, where we hopefully will identify best practices for improving rural justice system statewide. Yet despite our best hopes, we're mindful that the challenges we've faced since the days of the territory and have persisted through the first half century of statehood, it's a long road and we're facing a steep and steady climb. But it's a journey we must take and take together if we're going to bring our services in rural Alaska to the level our rural residents demand and deserve. Finally, we're striving to serve Alaskans by resolving their disputes more promptly. Together, we've made the swift resolution of child protection cases our top priority. Once a child in need of aid appeal has been fully briefed and argued by the parties and submitted to the Supreme Court for decision, the court's issuing a written decision within just a few months. But with the rising number of child in need of aid appeals, more than double in the last year, we began to observe that the agency attorneys for the parents, the guardians ad litem, and the State Office of Children's Services were asking for longer extensions to file their briefs. This threatened to create unacceptable postponements and a potential backlog in these critical cases, and that would be an intolerable result. Many abused or neglected children in these cases are waiting to be adopted. A delay of a few extra months may go by quickly for an adult, but this period of time can be an eternity for a child waiting for a permanent home. The Supreme Court's informed the attorneys that we will be enforcing existing court rules, which require expedited briefs in these child protection appeals and which limit the availability of briefing extensions. And there's a related crisis emerging in the ability of the parties to meet their briefing obligations in criminal appeals. As our felony jury trial rates climb, more appeals of resulting convictions are filed. During the first 6 months of this fiscal year alone, the number of appeals of criminal convictions has jumped by 33% over the same period of the previous year. Chief Judge David Mannheimer of the Court of Appeals reports that it's now taking the attorneys close to 2 years to file the briefs in a criminal appeal, rather than the 80 days specified under the appellate rules. Even with routine extensions for both sides under the rules, briefing should be complete within about 5 months. Our Constitution guarantees to criminal defendants a right of appeal, and to all victims of crime, the right to a timely disposition of a case. There can be no finality to a criminal conviction until the appeal is decided. Defendants, victims, and their families are now left waiting years for their cases to be finally resolved. You recognize the need for closure for victims when you passed legislation requiring that they be informed of any pending motion for continuance that could cause substantial delay. And you define substantial delay in a criminal appeal as 6 months or longer. Waiting for 2 years before even the briefs of the parties are completed in a criminal appeal is untenable. It may even compromise public safety, because the prosecution's ability to retry the case in the event of a reversible error at trial can be impaired by such extensive delay. Witnesses may not recall the details of an event that occurred many years earlier, or they may not be available at all. Just as it is the court's responsibility to enforce existing rules to ensure expedited resolution of child in need of aid appeals, the court is responsible to enforce the rules that protect the constitutional rights of defendants and victims to timely resolution of criminal appeals. We recognize that with the rising number of appeals in both child protection and criminal cases, the enforcement of existing appellate rules will affect the state agencies that handle the bulk of these appeals: the Public Defender Agency, the Office of Public Advocacy, and the State Attorney General's Office. While these agencies are making diligent efforts to discharge their duties, it appears that they don't have the capacity to keep up with this striking increase in appeals, and they will no doubt continue to be stretched by the rising trial rates and resulting heavy appellate caseloads, and there's no end in sight. We want to work cooperatively with these agencies to help them meet reasonable briefing deadlines. In fact, the Court of Appeals has adopted a phased approach to reduce the excessive delay in criminal appeal briefing. But appellate delay has the potential to harm the interests of everyone in the justice system: abused and neglected children, victims and their families, defendants, and the law enforcement and child protection agencies that investigate these cases. It's the court's responsibility to serve our communities by ensuring that our justice system functions effectively. It appears that at a minimum, some form of temporary relief to these agencies will be necessary to break this appellate logjam. With our commitment to stewardship and service, we can continue to perform our mission of deciding cases fairly, expeditiously, and at the lowest possible cost. But as always, we couldn't do it without you. Collaboration and innovation remain essential as we respond to the demands our responsibility for justice places upon us. And we must continue to seize opportunities to learn from each other and to share mutual concerns. We are so grateful to those of you who participated in the Judicial Ride-Along program this past year, which allowed many of you to accompany judges across the state as they perform their daily tasks on the bench. And we are grateful, as always, to those of you who have brought your particular concerns to our attention. Progress never seems to come fast enough as we seek to serve the public good. But it's important to remember that many of the challenges we face have been with us for generations, long before our time. And these issues will continue to challenge those of us who work in the halls of government for generations after we're gone. In the end, the quality of our stewardship won't be judged by whether we solve every problem facing our justice system that history's placed on our plate. Our efforts to be good stewards will be judged instead by whether we did all we could with what we had when it was our turn to make a difference. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you today.
This special broadcast of Chief Justice Dana Fabe's State of the Judiciary Address to the Alaska Legislature has been produced by 360 North and KTOO News in Juneau. Thank you for joining us.